Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel, coming to you today from a very blustery Sapporo in Japan. Today we'll be talking to Ji-yeon Jo, Associate Professor of Korean Language and Culture at the Department of Asian Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, about her new book, Homing, An Affective Topography of Ethnic Korean Return Migration, which was published this year, 2018, by Hawaii University Press. Now, for anyone with an interest in Korean studies, the study of diaspora and globalization, and indeed in broader questions around transnational identities and encounters in East Asia and beyond, this is very likely to be an extremely useful text. In it, Professor Jo weaves together a wide array of fascinating, and I should say very often moving, personal encounters with members of the long-standing Korean communities in China, the former Soviet Union, and the United States, members of which have moved back. And there are reasons you can kind of hear air quotes there in my voice, which we'll discuss perhaps during the interview, to South Korea, generally since the 1990s. Prior to presenting this material, which she draws largely from personal interviews, Professor Jo also offers rich background on how the Chinese, Soviets, and US-Korean diaspora communities became established in the first place, and also how they came to be inclined to return to the Korean Peninsula in recent decades. But this book is much more than just a historical summary or collection of interview findings, for it builds up a sophisticated set of arguments which highlight, in the author's own words, diasporic diversities and specificities among each of the Chinese, Soviet, and American groups. It is through Professor Jo's tracings of parallels and divergences between returnee diaspora experiences and the theoretical optic through which she considers these that the book's wider questions emerge to the fore, as we are encouraged, again in Professor Jo's own words, to rethink legacy migration through the lens of transborder belongings. In any case, though, these and many other matters will be dealt with at much greater length during our conversation. And so without further ado, I should say, Ji-yeon Jo, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the generous introduction and thanks for having me.
That was a pleasure. I really enjoyed the book. So it's great to have the chance to talk to you today. Now, Ji-yeon, I was wondering if you could begin the interview just by telling us a bit about yourself, your background, and how you became interested in your area of study.
So I'm a qualitative social scientist trained in the field of educational sociology with specific focus on Asian and Korean immigration history, sociology, critical pedagogy, and heritage language acquisition and maintenance. I received a PhD from the School of Education at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and currently teaching at the Department of Asian Studies at UNC Chapel Hill as an associate professor of Korean language and culture. And I teach courses such as Korean diasporas, Asian American experience, introductory courses on modern Korean history, society, and education, and advanced Korean language courses. So I first became interested in the later generation Korean Americans' experience of growing up in the United States when I had the opportunity to teach Korean language to college students as a teaching assistant a decade ago. So in my class and outside of the class, my students often talked about how much they had wanted to distance themselves from the Korean community and their heritage language, and how much they resisted learning Korean language, right? when they were young. So, however, they all became interested in knowing more about their heritage and language when they came to college. So I was very fascinated by their stories and wanted to learn more about the social and educational context of their identity development, especially during the transition to college. So, yeah, a few years later of that, my teaching experience, when I wanted to pursue a PhD degree, I started to search for a PhD program where I could study those issues. As you could imagine, in late 1990s, 2000, not many programs could, support those kind of research ideas. So I found a program. I found a program called Culture, Curriculum, and Change in the School of Education at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So the program had very strong interdisciplinary and critical approach to study education. So which allowed me to pursue my interest in the identity development of Korean American young adults at first. Mm-hmm. So to understand, please continue.
Mm-hmm.
So to understand the context of Korean Americans, I also had to study Asian American history and educational experiences. So during my graduate study, I also realized the local context of U.S. South is very much important factor of identity development. So by dissertation research, I interviewed Korean American students who grew up in the U.S. South, mainly North Carolina, and interviewed when they were senior in high school and again freshman in college, and wrote a dissertation titled Transforming Identity, Korean American Students in Transition from High School to College and Their Educational Experiences in the South. So,
And then how did that develop into the book project, the project of the book that we're discussing today, Homing, with the inclusion of the Chinese and Russian elements?
So afterwards, because of my research and training in second language acquisition, especially heritage language acquisition of Korean Americans, led me to my initial teaching job at the Asian Studies Department at UNC Chapel Hill. And during my over time, I visited South Korea, right, over the summer. I became aware of the increasing foreigner population in South Korea. I'm talking about in 2000s, right? Early 2000s, which included, not only Korean Americans, that also included, I also observed many of my students wanted to go back and teach English in Korea too, right? But I also, a greater number of later generation Korean Chinese are coming to Korea. So I was also a big concerned about the ways in which later generation diaspora Koreans are received in South Korea, and especially how Korean Chinese were stereotyped in South Korea and how they were received differently from the way Korean Americans are received in South Korea.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely something that's very noticeable there, speaking to South
Koreans. It's still about continuous, right?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So, at that time, I was quite familiar with the Korean American history and their life circumstances, but I didn't know much about the history of Korean diaspora in other parts of the world. So I was curious about their experiences living in South Korea and also their diaspora history too. So I wanted to know more about it, and I started my project Homing with just simple, basic intellectual curiosity. And I was particularly interested in later generation diaspora Korean returnees rather than the first generation returnees, because later generations are migrating to Korea without much knowledge, prior knowledge and experience in the country, but they indeed are migrating. So in subsequent field work in South Korea between 2009 and 2012, I started to meet later generation diaspora Koreans who had migrated to South Korea or lived in there for a long term and interview them. So I interviewed diaspora Koreans from the, as you introduced in the beginning, from three major regions, the United States, China, and the Commonwealth of Independent States, right? The former Soviet blocs. They're the three major groups of returnees. So my book, Homing, is based on about 63 interviews that I conducted with diaspora Korean returnees. And I also met about 30 people whose works involve diaspora Korean communities and returnee communities. And I attended cultural and religious events and, to better understand the experience of quote and unquote return. So I would like to mention that I always use the word return with quotation marks, because for the later generation diaspora Koreans, South Korea is their ancestral homeland, not their actual homeland. And yeah, they don't have any first-hand experience with the country before they moved to South Korea.
Although perhaps in many cases, their backgrounds may not even have been in the southern part of the peninsula originally, right? Their ancestral villages and towns might have been at the north.
Uh-huh. Yes, exactly. So I decided to call the later generation diaspora Korean migrants as a legacy migrant. And their acts of moving as homing, which signifies the continuous movement and connection between diaspora and their very putative, right, ancestral homeland and the migration trajectory.
Right. Well, I think that's a great point at which to move on to discuss the book in more detail, perhaps, with that quite succinct summary, I think, of the key word in the title there. So now that we understand something about where the book came from and how you came to write it and the projects that underlay it, perhaps we should dive right in. As you explain in the introduction to the book, Homing is organized into two parts. So perhaps you'd like to go ahead and describe for us the first three chapters, right? Part one.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So in the first part, which I titled as Histories and Memories, I provide general overview of the three diaspora regions, the United States, China, and the Commonwealth of Independent States, and looks into the politics of citizenship and belonging, and language and educational experiences. And also I include the legacy migrants' own experiences, their own narratives of growing up. So each section is organized somewhat similar way. I provide the policies, nationality policies, and minority policies of each diaspora region, and how they were accepted as citizens or denied as a citizens in the country. And also as a person whose work is very much involved in heritage language maintenance, one of my major focus is also their relationships with their heritage language, Korean as a heritage language, and also the language of diaspora.
So perhaps you'd like to describe how does that vary? I mean, in that first part, you have three separate chapters, firstly on the Chinese Koreans, secondly on those in the Commonwealth of Independent States, and thirdly about those in the United States, given that language is, as you say, such an animating feature of your study as a whole. Perhaps could you just briefly sum up what is the linguistic situation and the sort of minority policies towards Koreans in each of those three places?
So for Koreans in China, their language rights are protected by the ethnic minority policies. So, if you go to Yanbian Prefecture, especially the city of Yanji, you will see Korean signages, right, above of Chinese language. So,
Yeah.
And also I show the picture on my cover of my book Homing too.
That's right.
So and also they could get their classroom instructions in Korean, and they learn Chinese as one of the the second language or the mainstream language, right? But they get Chinese instruction, but the other classroom instructions, subject matters are conducted in Korean if they are to choose to attend, you know, Joseonjok school, Korean Chinese schools. And so although the percentage of people who maintains Korean as a heritage language has decreased in recent years, in general, over 80% of Korean Chinese could communicate in Korean. And many older generations, their dominant language is Korean, not Chinese. Although they were born and raised in China, they're multi-generation, right? Korean Chinese. So that's very much different from the context of maintaining heritage language in the Commonwealth of Independent States. And
right. And in terms of the former Soviet republics, where specifically are we talking about here? Where are the dominant populations of Koreans in the former Soviet space?
Yes. So, you know, the language policy during the Soviet era in itself is a complicated matter. So I don't want to delve too much into it. But because of the changes in policy, they were first encouraged to speak the ethnic language, but later they're completely forbidden to speak the language. So many later generation, second and third generation, ended up forgetting Korean language in their diaspora. And the new generation, I'm talking about the, you know, Korean Russians and Koreans in Kazakhstan and in Sakhalin, they are relearning Korean as a second language, not as a heritage language, because after 1990s, many Korean missionaries and Korean governments started to establish Korean language schools. So as a community, they have forgotten the Korean language in large part, but the younger generations are relearning Korean language at this time.
And in terms of a comparison between the Soviet or former Soviet and Chinese cases, do you see perhaps one big difference in the relative maintenance of Korean language amongst those two communities? Would you say that had something to do with the dislocation of the Soviet Koreans from the far eastern part of Russia to Central Asia, which occurred during the 1930s under Stalin, whereas the Chinese community stayed quite densely sort of living together in one place? Would you say that was a factor in the language maintenance situation?
Oh, yes, yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that was a major, one of the major event in the Korean in former Soviet Union, the 1937 deportation to Central Asia. And even after the deportation, they tried to maintain heritage language. The first thing they established is they brought some books, right? And also Korea Theater was kind of moved with them. And they tried to maintain, you know, the Korea Theater and tried to establish a school, small community school to maintain. But later on, with the Stalin era, they changed the educational policy and language policy, and they were prohibited. And some of my older generation, Korean Russians, they told me that their parents wanted to sing Arirang, mm-hmm. but they couldn't.
That's a popular public, Korean
right?
folk.
They were like, you know, yeah, small, small voices. They would sing, you know, humming in their house, right? So yeah, that's very much different. And I agree that the deportation had language.
Right. And how about the American case, moving on to chapter 3?
Yeah, so the Korean Americans, you know, the major location of heritage language education is community schools. And, you know, weekend Saturday schools or Friday night schools. And those are not supported by the educational department. It's kind of a community operated and supported institutions, right? Very informal educational institutions. So in large part, the young generation of Korean Americans grew up as seeing Korea not being very valued from the larger society. So if you talk to Korean Americans in their 20s, late 20s and 30s and 40s, they didn't get to learn Korean when they were young, especially when they lived outside of the metropolitan area where they don't even have Korean community schools. It was very hard for them to learn. And also, you get the sense that the larger community, the mainstream community, do not value Korean language, and they didn't want them because it's an extra burden. You have to do your all schoolwork, and then in addition, you have to go to a Korean school in Friday.
This is a relatively common diaspora experience, perhaps, amongst groups with attempting to sustain minority languages overseas. It can be a challenge, I think, from that point of view. So you found that the Korean American situation with regard to language compared somewhat favorably, perhaps, to the former Soviet case, or definitely it's considerably less maintained linguistically than the Chinese case, but where did you see it fitting in that sort of picture?
Yeah, so in terms of the maintenance rate, the former Soviet Union countries in Central Asia and Russia and the United States, the later generations maintained about, you know, a little over 10% plus minus. So the later generation maintenance, heritage language maintenance rate is very, very low. However, if you look at the data, census data, it'll show that the Korean language maintenance rate is very high, because that's due to the fact that the over 60% of Korean Americans are first generation.
I see. So interesting.
Without the flow of first generation immigrants in the United States, they could have lost, you know, a lot. Severely, they could, but they maintained because of constant flow of first generation immigrants since 1965. Right. And but for the Koreans in Commonwealth of Independent States, the flow was not possible until, you know, after 1990s.
Right. No, that makes sense. Well, that's great. I mean, that's a really good overview of that first initial part. And I should say that actually we've only touched on a few kind of general issues which are discussed there by Professor Zhou. And really, there's a huge amount more that is very rich in that section. And I should really add that actually, based on some of my own research, there's actually a singular lack of information I found about a lot of the background to Chinese and Soviet Korean communities in English especially. And so it's tremendously useful to have all of this gathered together in one place. And I think that's a real contribution that the book makes. And indeed, I would also like to flag up one particular element, which I found especially kind of intriguing, the ways that the different communities discuss their diaspora position and the place that they have in their respective countries. There was a brilliant section on the metaphors which the Korean Chinese use to discuss their own position in China and as that relates to Korea. So look out for that in chapter one. In any case, moving on to part two now, I think, which is really where the real meat of the book, if you like, is to be found, and where I suppose a lot of the material from the interviews really comes to shine. Now, Professor Zhou, you begin part two by discussing how legacy Korean migrants fit into South Korean society, specifically in terms of social space. Would you be able to begin by saying something about that and how chapter four kind of unfolds?
So, the second part, which I titled as Odyssey of Homing, traces the various experiences of legacy migrants in South Korea and their continuing transnational connections and disconnections with their previous diaspora community and family in diaspora. So the second part is divided into four chapters. And first chapter is chapter four, right? Looks into the overall experiences of legacy migrants' migration to South Korea. And I highlight their processes of finding and creating social spaces for them. And the second chapter, chapter five, focuses on the issues of citizenship, juxtaposing the changing legal juridical notions of the citizenship in South Korea and legacy migrants' perspectives on citizenship and belonging in the country. And the third chapter, chapter six, explore how Korean as a heritage language influences and also influenced by legacy migrants' membership status and affective belonging both in diaspora and in South Korea. And in the following chapter, the fourth chapter, I discuss how the interplay between legal juridical notions of citizenship and socioculturally mediated belonging affects family lives of legacy migrants, and how and why transborder ties between legacy migrants and their kin have been maintained or broken due to their migration. So I pay special attention to the production of transborder kinship in chapter seven.
Right, right. No, that's great. Yeah, that part two really covers many of the most important bases, I think it's fair to say, in Korean returnee experiences in South Korea. So returning to chapter four, perhaps we can begin there with how the social spaces that you describe are created by each of those respective communities. Could you perhaps describe how that occurs among these migrants back in South Korea?
Yeah, so, I talk about their first encounters in South Korea and their feeling of being migrated to South Korea. And I found different people experience differently, and especially large numbers of Koreans from CIS finding comfort in Korea, and they continuously use the word comfort in English to me, and how much they feel like they are home, even though they didn't grow up and they didn't know much, but they thought living in Korea and living amongst co-ethnics gave them the comfort. And maybe that's in large part due to the animosity they have experienced in Central Asia republics because of their ethnic priority policies after the fall of the Soviet Union. But for other groups, especially Korean Americans and Korean Chinese, their migration kind of gave them the disillusionment about, the Korea they imagined, the gap between the Korea they imagined and they experienced. And in South Korea, even though at first, they didn't have much social network in South Korea. My interlocutors tried to find the legacy migrants who came from the same region or who shares same language through internet and also by attending churches and participating in cultural events. So, and also for Chinese, Korean Chinese, they kind of reunited with their school alumni. So they created their own alumni association. And they told me that, people are flying from Busan or Jeju if they have an alumni association meeting in Seoul. So, and they told me they didn't have those in China because they didn't need to, right? But in Yeah, they wanted to reconnect with each other and share their experiences. So they're creating diaspora networks in South Korea too.
So almost a kind of diaspora within a diaspora. Almost.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And how about the Korean American community there?
So Korean Americans are largely, maybe it's based on my limited number of interlocutors, but their social networks are largely dependent on the churches, religious networks. And because there are quite a few Korean American pastors who also migrated back to South Korea, and they established their ministry in South Korea. So around those returnee Korean American pastors, Korean Americans congregate, and then they do Sunday services together and activities together. So I observe that the religious aspect is a strong networking.
And much more so than among the former Soviet or Chinese Koreans. Does religion play a part at all in their communities?
So Korean Chinese communities also religion plays a part because Korean churches provide a lot of support to legal supports and social supports for the Korean Chinese, especially for the laborers. However, the difference is that they attend churches that are established by the Korean, South Korean pastors. Not many Korean Chinese move to South Korea to establish their churches. So that's the difference between Korean Chinese and Korean American religious groups. And I found Koreans from CIS also interacts in churches too, but because of their smaller number, their churches are usually housed within large Korean churches. So they go to Russian services conducted within large Korean churches. And in the Russian services, I found that Korean Russians and also others, just Russians without Korean heritage, also comes together and worship together. So it's more of a diverse, like language-based church community for Koreans. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, that's very interesting. And how about in terms of physical space and how that relates to social space? Are these communities, as they relate through religion and through, as you say, school alumni networks and so on, are they also living in close proximity to one another? Are there physical communities, of people from the same diaspora communities who congregate in certain areas of South Korean cities? Is that occurring amongst any of these groups?
Yeah, I think it's occurring among Korean Chinese community more so than Korean from CIS or Korean Americans. So, for example, the Korean Chinese community members live southwestern part of the Seoul, Daebangdong area and Gurodong area, and they establish their own communities and community networks, and also you can find many stores owned by Korean Chinese stores, restaurants. So they have a sizable community, and also the new community established near Konguk University area, and you can see quite a few Korean Chinese restaurants right in that community too. Korean Russians, they do have a small pocket of places, but in that places too, they are kind of integrated with other Russian communities. And then they have operates or works at Russian restaurants and small stores too.
I see. And Korean Americans, are there clusters of Korean
Americans? They tend to be spread out in their living spaces. Oh, and one interesting space that Koreans from CIS created is actually one space in Gwangju. So Gwangju has Koreans from CIS. They live in close proximity, and they have their own radio station. They have their own like business network, and they have like co-ops. So Gwangju is one of the larger community that Koreans from CIS established.
I see. Oh, that's very interesting. So there are these kind of in provincial cities as well outside Seoul, there are concentrations of some of these groups. That's a great kind of encapsulation of how the Korean communities, the diasporic Korean communities themselves, are forging both social and physical and other kinds of networks within South Korea itself. Perhaps we can move on now to talk about Chapter 5 and the citizenship regimes and how their relationships with the state kind of operate, because I think perhaps that's a key component within how their social networks evolve, right? In terms that their relationship with the South Korean state often has a decisive bearing, perhaps, on the way that they forge communities among themselves and self-organize. So perhaps you could say a bit about Chapter 5.
Mm-hmm. So in Chapter 5, I provide background of how citizenship laws have changed over the last two decades in response to the growing overseas community, growing foreign migrants, especially the diaspora returnees, which I call legacy migrants. And it is very contested. It has been very contested field, because at first they didn't want to include Koreans and Koreans from CIS into the more easier way to pathway to Korean citizenship and permanent residency. And through the social activism that were supported by, again, the activist Korean pastors, they kind of, they were included, Koreans from China and diaspora Koreans CIS were included in the new Nationality Act and Overseas Act. However, they created two different tracks. So if you are engaged in low-skilled labor, you could get H-2 visa, right? But if you're getting college education, especially the master's or doctorate degree, you're eligible to get F-4 visas. So they kind of created two different tracks of visa status. And
so did this visa regime and ultimately citizenship regime, was this something that had its origins for all, as you say, except all overseas Korean communities apart from the CIS Koreans back in the 90s in South Korea? Or what were the kind of origins of this returnee legacy migrant visa and citizenship regime?
Yeah, so it is a late 1990s product, but it deemed as unconstitutional. So now they have amended the Overseas Korean Act.
I see. So now it applies equally to all of the overseas Korean communities, the returnee legacy migrants that you're discussing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I see. And so what are the sort of stories that you encountered among the other groups of returnee Koreans, the Chinese and American Koreans, is with regard to citizenship, with regard to their aspirations to attain citizenship, and so on?
Despite the hypes of giving legal citizenship to diaspora Koreans or not, the actual number of people who change their citizenship to South Korean citizenship is very low compared to other centers of the migration, like United States and Canada. And I found out the diaspora legacy migrants are kind of looking in, not only the South Korean government wants to control and exercise their mechanism to include and exclude legacy migrants. Legacy migrants themselves, as an agent of their own life, they some of them did not even want to get Korean citizenship, even though they're qualified to do, right? So I divided them into like five groups of citizens, depending on their status and also orientation and attitude towards Korean citizenship. And I divided them, categorized them as precarious citizens who wanted to get working rights or even the citizenship, but they're totally excluded from the citizenship category, and contingent citizens who consider South Korean citizenship as a stepping stone to move to other countries such as Europe or especially United States. And the permanently temporary citizens are people, especially Korean Americans, who kind of came to Korea as to teach English or to have a better job opportunity, but who couldn't advance themselves more than that. They were kind of stay in plateau in their career trajectory. And even if they come to the United States, they may not establish, they may not be able to establish a professional career in the United States due to the fact that they stay Korea for the extended period of time. And then the flexible citizens are citizens who is highly qualified and highly capable, highly educated, who's not really attached to a single nation, whose trajectory of migration is open very widely to United States, to their diaspora land and in South Korea, because they are very highly demanded in the market, job market. And then the community citizens are those who want to make South Korea as their home and stay there, although they want to make their heritage, diasporic heritage.
And among the three different communities, which categories did you find each one most fit into? Or were there more of one group of Koreans who were seeking to settle permanently? In terms of, obviously, this categorization cross-cuts each of the three different sort of national origins of the communities you're discussing. But was it the case that, say, there was a larger proportion of CIS Koreans who were interested in permanent settlement, or a larger proportion of Chinese Koreans who were interested in South Korea as a stepping stone elsewhere? Or did you find that there was any particular weighting in that direction, or was it quite distributed across the board?
It was very much mixed in that, but I could see some tendency of Koreans from CIS are more committed citizens. And the highly educated Korean Chinese and Korean Americans are more flexible citizens, but somewhat like college educated and especially the English teachers of Korean Americans are usually fall into the permanently temporary citizens.
Okay, well, perhaps now we can move on to the topic, which, you know, I think perhaps is maybe closest to your heart of all of the various kind of subject areas that you cover in this second part, namely the subject covered in chapter six, the language question. Perhaps you could introduce us to your sixth chapter, Shifting Affective Linguascapes.
Yes. So as a title, title is self-explanatory. The linguascapes in South Korea is shifting because of the legacy migration and also the foreign resident, increasing number of foreign residents in South Korea. Mm-hmm.
Would you mind just saying us clarifying a little what you mean by linguascapes? Is that this term comes from Arjuna Padarai? Is that correct? You're borrowing from his idea. Could you just fill out that idea for us a bit?
Yeah. So the linguascape is the reservoir or daily interaction of the language incorporated in a person's environment. So it could be linguascape, could for the South Koreans, was mainly Korean language before before they experienced foreign residents, increasing number of foreign residents. But now, with the growing number of Chinese tourists and also migrants from other countries, the linguascapes, the languages that South Koreans are exposed to or legacy migrants are exposed to, are diversified and multiplied. Mm-hmm. And that, in a sense, it's kind of your landscape of language or your language environment is kind of a linguascape. So, and I wanted to kind of challenge and problematize the South Koreans, the dominant notion of Korean language in this chapter, and how their expectations to legacy migrants are sometimes unrealistic. And because of their co-ethnic status, legacy migrants are expected to speak Korean more fluent than other foreign migrants.
Right, and language is seen as a specific badge of Korean belonging. Is that right?
Yes, the identity, right? And while experiencing those dominant pressure, Korean Chinese and Korean Americans, especially, they kind of challenge South Koreans' mainstream notion of what Korean language should be, right? So in the second section of the chapter 6, I introduce the claims and narratives of Korean Chinese and Korean Americans and the language that South Koreans speaks and uses are lacking authenticity because Korean Chinese claims that they maintained more antique form, the more original form of Korean language in their diaspora, better than South Koreans whose language has been contaminated. That's the word they used, contaminated by all the English, right? And the Korean Americans will argue that, the English that South Koreans are using are kind of Konglish. It's not like real English, you know. The Americans would use shampoo and conditioner, not shampoo and rinse, right? So those kind of differences. And so the using of English, the overuses of English among South Koreans are criticized by both Korean Chinese and Korean Americans, and to a certain extent, Koreans from CIS too, that even though they can speak Korean, they cannot understand South Korean sometimes because of the overuse of the English.
Right, right. Yeah,
Koreanized English, I should say.
You see in the bookshops in Yanbian, the Korean area of Northeast China, you see dictionaries designed especially for Korean Chinese people of English words that are used in Korean.
Yeah,
I noticed these in bookshops.
But that's interesting.
Would you say that this kind of argument, by Korean Chinese that they've preserved a sort of original traditional form of Korean, and then in turn by Korean Americans that they're using true English and that Koreans are butchering it? Do those come in response to a specific kind of impression they have of how welcoming Korea is, or why are they pushed to sort of come up with these narratives?
It is very much related to the discrimination they have experienced because of their accents and the way they use Korean language in South Korea. So I see that as a kind of defensive maneuvers of they incorporated while living in Korea. However, they are not like rejecting Korean language completely. They recognize the increased value of knowing Korean language in their future job market and also everyday Korean lives. So in their actual lives, they incorporate their Korean language and they want to learn more about, right? They're not like completely denying to learn Korean language. They want to learn. But however, on the face of discrimination, they activate these defensive maneuvers, and they would claim that the Koreans are not using the authentic Korean language.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's interesting. And actually, there was one other thing from chapter six that I wanted to flag up because it's a curious little additional element. The CIS Koreans, you say, essentially develop their own language in their diaspora community, this language Koryomal. I was just wondering if you could explain a little more about what Koryomal was and what effects it had when people who spoke it arrived in South Korea and tried to use it.
Yeah, so Koryomal was emerged from, diaspora community. It's not completely unrelated to the Korean language, but it shows the how Korean language they used have been changed, right, due to the influence of the Russians in their daily lives and also different regions of the Korean language. First, Koryomal was heavily influenced by the diaspora Koreans who migrated from the northeastern part of Korean Peninsula. But later, they were joined by Koreans from southeastern part or southern parts coming to Russia. So they had language interaction between two different dialects of Korean and plus Russians, right? So they actually, changed their last names to look more like Russian last names. So like last name Ma is Magai. So they add I, right, A-Y or Gai, G-A-Y to their last names and then, kind of lossified their last names and their pronunciation has been changed a little bit. So the hybrid forms of language interaction created Koryomal, and they thought because they used Koryomal in their diaspora, they thought Koryomal is the Korean language, right? But after they visit or come to South Korea, they realize that Koryomal, you can't really, you can communicate basic knowledge, but South Koreans would experience a hard time understanding them, and also they would have a hard time understanding South Koreans as well.
Sure. Oh, that's one of many absolutely fascinating details that unfold in that language chapter. And then finally, before getting to the conclusion, perhaps you can say something about chapter seven, the kinship-focused chapter, because this is also really a key strand in the sustenance and existence of many of these legacy migrant communities.
It was a bit heartbreaking chapter to write about because of the migration, many legacy migrants had experienced separation from their families. And many times it's a very long-term separation like that goes over decades of separation from family members, especially for Korean Chinese, right? And also even after they are reunited in South Korea, they find that they can't relate to their parents or children as much as they wanted to, because they have huge affective ruptures, right? They experienced. And also I talk about, the notion of caring, how children who are left in diaspora were materially cared by their migrated parents, but they were lacking of the emotional caring from the caretaker in their diaspora. And I want to highlight that still many legacy migrants live in separated life from their family members and even their children. For example, the migrants from CIS, because of the financial burden to bring their family members to South Korea, because the living cost is so high, they chose to live separately and then just send remittances to Central Asian region, their country.
I see. So they get kind of stuck in situations which keep them divided. I see. Yeah. And as you say, I mean, there are a great many very heartbreaking stories and also very moving stories of how committed mothers or relatives remain to their children or offspring or vice versa after years and years of separation, and the questions that are asked there about whether the choice to move and leave a child behind, for example, in China was the correct one. And really, yeah, I think I would point listeners towards this chapter of the book because there's a tremendously kind of there's a tremendous amount of rich material in there. I was wondering actually methodologically, and this is perhaps a late point to be asking about such a thing, but when it came to eliciting some of these more perhaps delicate and personal stories, did you apply any particular sort of techniques in during interviews, and were you specifically looking for these stories, or did they emerge relatively synthetically relatively naturally? How did that happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my interview was very, you know, semi-structured interview. I opened it up to the interlocutors to talk about their experiences. However, and also, you know, it is very challenging to build the trust within a very limited time, right? And so I usually start my interviews by introducing myself and my experiences of living in the United States as an immigrant and as a minority. And I believe my experience, they kind of relate to my experience. So I opened up myself a little bit and then move on to explaining about the research and why I am interested in hearing about their stories. So, and also I assure them of protecting their privacy and maintaining the confidentiality of the information, because many of them, especially those who were once undocumented migrants, still they gained the legal status in South Korea. They kind of have remained fear of the South Korean system due to their past experiences. So I found it is very important for them to make it clear that this will be all confidential, and I'm going to use pseudonyms for all their stories, so you know no one can identify them, right, in their real life, other than myself. And you know, I felt very honored and fortunate that my interlocutors opened their hearts to me, sometimes in a very, very intense way. And I sensed that many of them felt connected, as I mentioned, with my experiences as migrants living overseas. I also sensed that they had stories. All of them had great stories and sometimes heartbreaking stories, but they didn't have chance to tell anyone candidly, even to their families, because in many times the family members are often too entangled in their stories and too, you know, co-implicated in their everyday lives. They couldn't even tell to their family members. And also they kind of had some reservations to tell their stories to South Koreans, because even to South Korean researchers, because they felt that, you know, the system is there. The South Korea itself is a dominant system that has discriminated them, right, in South Korea. So I think my position as a Korean American researcher kind of helped me to get connected with them.
Absolutely, yeah, and that comes across really clearly, and I think that's a great point at which to sort of move towards wrapping up. I should say, yes, that these really fascinating stories about all manner of different aspects of the rich experiences and lives and sort of improvisational efforts and linguistic strategies and social network creation and so on that are there amongst all of these different communities. They all really shine throughout the text. So I would encourage all listeners to go out and buy it right away if they haven't done already and get reading. And so, yes, well, all that remains, Gion, is to say we've taken up an awful lot of your time, and thank you very much. Before you go, perhaps you could say something about what you're working on currently. This is the New Books Network's traditional final question. So what current projects do you have in the pipeline, and what are you working on at the moment?
So I'm currently working on a project about diaspora Korean cinema, which encompasses cinema directed by diaspora Korean auteurs in the United States, Japan, China, and other parts of the world. So if homing was my attempt to understand the lives of diaspora and return migration through personal narratives, my current project is to learn about them through the cinematic works of diaspora Korean auteurs on diaspora subjects. So in addition to the diaspora Korean cinema project, I have two other concurrent writing and research projects. One is on educational issues of foreign marriage migrants in South Korea, and the other is on transnational consumptions and identities of multi-generation Korean Americans.
Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating, and I look forward a lot to reading the results of those projects when they come out. In any case, Gion, Professor Jo, I really want to thank you a great deal again for appearing on the show today. It was great talking to you, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. It was really nice talking to you.